Hey guys, this is Richard Sachs from Lost Arts Radio. Nice to be with you again. We've got an exciting, fun guest for me today. Joel Skousen, somebody I've been watching for many years on Alex's show, read some of his books, and followed a lot of his information. Now just got into World Affairs Brief, which is great. Recommend that to everybody. And I want to, the purpose of inviting him onto the show was that I've had the opportunity to hear a lot of kind of short segments of his when there would be a commercial break or the end of Alex being able to have him on, something like that. And the things that he mentioned in the time that he had were so intriguing. It made me feel like there's a lot more there. And he's teaching from direct experience and direct investigation, which I tremendously appreciate. I think that we have a scarcity of real teachers right now, and it's not by mistake. Certainly in the general school system and the media, they've just about disappeared, and teachers have become facilitators, reading down a checklist instead of teaching from their experience and wisdom, and I want to bring that back, among other things. So I mentioned that he's the author of The Secure Home and Strategic Relocation. Just made myself a couple of notes. Frequent guests on Alex's show. Somebody that I think deserves to be known a lot better, and I'm sure that you guys will agree. I want to hear more of his background. So my suggestion, Joel, for the brief time that we've got today, is that why don't we start, since you're obviously coming from some kind of a background that allows you to have some insights into current developments and history, let's go back first as far as you want to in your background, that go through the steps that put you in a position to be able to do the things that you're doing now. And then whatever time we have after that, let's start with history, because it's hardly even being taught anymore. And back as far as you would like to go and start stepping toward the present. And if we don't get very far, that's fine. You know, it'll be great, whatever it is. And we'll set another episode for the near future, I hope, and take people all the way up through where we can really start using that context to look at current events, if that's all right with you.
Yes, that's just great, Richard. Let me start with some of my background. I'm going to go clear back to when I was a younger teenager. My uncle was W. Cleon Skousen, who was the great constitutional scholar, and he was also the police chief of Salt Lake City in the days before corruption took over. He worked as an administrative assistant to J. Edgar Hoover in the FBI for many years, where he did a lot of his research initially on communism. Well, he ended up writing the book, The Naked Communist, which was more than just about exposing communism itself, but the second floor of the State Department, full of a lot of communists who were busy allowing communists to come into power, whether it was in the Soviet Union or China under George Catlett Marshall, or Cuba or Nicaragua. All of these things were facilitated from the second floor of the State Department. And it's still a very relevant book actually. People can still get it on Amazon, but it was very influential in my early life. I was raised in Oregon and went to a new high school there in the Beaverton, Oregon area. And it was before Oregon became a Marxist citadel as it is today, especially the Portland area. There were a lot of conservatives in Oregon in the rural area, and it hadn't been taken over by the urban megapolis as it has now. So my father was very active in politics locally there in Oregon, but he died when I was just 17 years old. of cancer, and he left behind 10 children and a widow of 36. It was a tough go, to say the least. But my uncle Cleon, we moved the family down to Utah so that we could go to Brigham Young University. If we lived there, we got scholarships to the university. We could go there for very little cost. And Cleon would visit us weekly and became kind of a surrogate father to our family, which was very much appreciated. And so I learned a lot about political history from Cleon. He ended up writing The Naked Capitalist later on, a commentary on Carol Quigley's expose of the globalists. Quigley was a globalist himself, didn't see why they had to keep it all secret. He was in agreement and he wanted to broadcast it to the world. Well, the globalists didn't take lightly to that. Tragedy, hope, they leaned on his widow to make sure that never got republished, but you can still find used copies elsewhere. And this was an outgrowth of Cleon's concern that there were a lot of people in the government who were protecting the communists in the State Department. And it's just like in the Roosevelt administration and Truman administration, which was full of communists, everyone from Alger Hiss, to Owen Lattimore and others were very instrumental in getting Roosevelt to be friends with Joe Stalin and give away Europe to Stalin after World War II.
I had told you that I'm not going to interrupt much at all, which is true. But just to make sure that we don't skip over anything quickly that's important, that's familiar to you, but people use this kind of language without really knowing what the words mean. And it might sound oversimplified, but I don't think it is. And what I want to ask you is, people use the word all the time, what's a communist?
Well, when I say communist, I mean someone who's an official member of the Communist Party, either secretly or openly, who is in line with the original communist goals as outlined in my uncle's book, The Naked Communist, which is open subversion. It's a radical socialist movement. I mean, socialism technically is the ownership and control of all means of production, but it's done by democratic rule. Communism is you do that by force. You end up killing the opposition. You control everything from cradle to grave, like the Soviet Union was. That's real communism. Okay. And now there's a lot of fellow travelers with communists who are Marxists at heart, but not members of the Communist Party. Our universities in the United States are still full of Marxists. And they are sympathetic to the ultimate goals of communism, which claims to have a dictatorship of the proletariat, meaning we rule and make sure there's no elite and there's no wealthy and we distribute wealth and we do it by force of government. And of course, they don't look at, communism. The old dictatorship of the proletariat was a misnomer. I mean, even the communists never believed in that. They've always lived in the lap of luxury, taking money. There's nothing about letting the proletariat rule at all. That was simply a...
The rulers live in luxury, right?
That's right. They sure do.
It's kind of like what Marx and Engels wrote about in the Communist Manifesto, right? You overthrow all the evil rich people except for the ones at the top and steal everything that they've got. Give it to the rulers who are supposedly going to distribute it to everybody.
That's right. And that's why, as when I'll talk about the fall of the Soviet Union, the people who really ran the show behind Gorbachev were the real leaders of Russia. They made themselves the oligarchs. So Berezovsky and Gusinski and all of those, they got the National Bank of the Soviet Union to loan them the money to buy Gazprom and buy the oil fields. And then, well, how did they get the banks to give them the loan of money? Well, they were the communist leaders. The bankers knew these were the secret leaders. So if they tell us they give them the money, we give them the money. That's never come out in the news. And that's part of what I do in my World Affairs Brief, is I tell what's going on behind the scenes that you never know in the mainstream media. But in any case, when I went to college, I was planning on being a lawyer like my father was. The Vietnam War came along, and in order to avoid being drafted, I decided to volunteer for the military service. I went into the Marine Corps. And I served at the tail end of the Vietnam era as a fighter pilot, flying the F-4 and the A-4. My squadron, when I joined it, had just come back from Vietnam, and so I didn't actually see combat in Vietnam, but I certainly saw the rather unsavory and immoral habits that people coming back from Vietnam bring with them back to the States, and the secrets that they want kept secret. Ultimately, that conflict between my moral values and the lack of moral values of my fellow officers who were combat veterans led me to leave the Marine Corps, somewhat disillusioned about honor and integrity and all the things that the Marine Corps thought that they stood for. But I did learn a lot in the Marine Corps about the yesmanship that is required of military officers, and how they all have to go through war college schools in Washington, D.C., and I found out that they were being indoctrinated by professors from Georgetown University who were all globalists. And that's why all of our top military officers, whether generals or in the Marine Corps or the Army or the admirals in the Navy, they're all globalists. Because you don't get to be a general officer unless you're an abject yes man. If they hint, if you give any hint at all that you're opposing the establishment, you will not be promoted general or admiral. Now, some of them come back to their senses and their true conservative background after they retire, but none of them ever blow the whistle when they're in uniform or they get kicked out. And so when Benghazi happened and there was a stand down order, there wasn't anybody that's going to talk about it who was in uniform, because they know they'd be crucified if they would ever admit that there was a stand down. It's very interesting, as a side, Trey Gowdy, who was running the Benghazi things, he actually got one of the lower ranking servicemen to admit from Benghazi, he was in one of the control centers, that he got a stand down order. And watching this on C-SPAN, we expected Trey Gowdy to say, well, who gave the order? Isn't that the natural thing you'd want to know if you're in Congress?
That makes sense.
Who told you to stand down? This was someone from the National Security Council.
Right.
He never asked the question. He just let it drop. The guy says, we got a stand down call. And he never asked the question, who gave the order?
It's a hint of the entire collusion between media and the deep state and everything else in between.
That's right. Well, when I got out of the military, I was left the military at the rank of captain. I had three kids, and it's kind of difficult to step into any of those fields and go back to education, when you've got three kids and a family to support.
Yeah.
So I'd always had an interest, because of my exposure early on to my uncle's work. I've always felt there was a conspiracy in government. And going back to what my uncle discovered when he wrote The Naked Capitalist, is that there were non-communists in government who were protecting the communists, and he didn't know who they were. And Quigley hinted about it, calling them, globalists and things that believed in a global world government and a benevolence and all that that Quigley believed in.
Right.
But, it was really kind of, and for example, I came to the conclusion later on after watching how the establishment protected Alger Hiss. You noticed Alger Hiss was fingered by one of the very good repentant, Whitaker Chambers, one of the good repentant communists that came out of the Roosevelt administration. And he said to Congress, I was there. I saw Alger Hiss take the oath to join the Communist Party. And Alger Hiss always denied that. But the establishment media never gave up on Alger Hiss. When he got convicted on perjury and be sent to prison for many years, they just continued to lobby for him. It kind of dawned on me one day that Alger Hiss wasn't really a communist, that he was a globalist who went in and joined the Communist Party so that they wouldn't think twice about how he was protecting them in the Roosevelt administration, how he was bringing in Owen Lattimore and all the other communists. They would think, he's one of us. It's the same reason why Henry Kissinger joined the Communist Party in East Germany, so that they would think that he's actually one of them. When he became the national security advisor to Richard Nixon, we got one of our own. But in fact, Kissinger was a globalist, not a communist.
But they wanted the globalists to be out of the limelight and blame the communists for stuff
like
that.
That's right. So this is a very deceptive world that we live in. And I decided that things weren't going to turn out very well from the United States. Clear back when I was 17, I designed my first high security residence. because I thought I'm going to need to prepare myself someday for this evil conspiracy that's in our government, which we now know we call the deep state. But unfortunately, the deep state, as constituted, as normally talked about, is viewed as a bunch of Obama administration holdovers, Democrats within the bureaucracy that are thwarting President Trump. Yeah. But in fact, the deep state is much broader, much more evil than that. These are not a bunch of political hacks. These people killed JFK. These people killed Robert F. Kennedy. They killed Martin Luther King. They covered up for the TW-800 shoot down, which was by an errant Navy missile that hit an airliner, and they covered that up. They did 9/11. It was a black operation from the very beginning, from hiring the terrorists to loading the explosives in the World Trade Center, especially Building 7, which came down in a controlled demolition. This was a deep state operation in order to justify intervention around the world and the destruction of constitutional liberties under the name of, we've got a rule on terrorism, so we've got the right for domestic spying. This is what opened up NSA spying for everything, which they've been doing before 9/11, but now it allowed them to justify it through the Patriot Act. So when I was, as I said, I began my career as a designer of high security homes and clear back in the late 70s, 1970s, and wrote my first book, The Secure Home, in 1979. It went through several iterations. It's in its fourth edition right now. But I was one of the pioneers in the survivalist or preparedness movement. It wasn't until about 1999 that I wrote Strategic Relocation. This was just prior to the Y2K disaster, which Dr. Gary North was the one who blew the whistle for the whole nation on what this could do. And the government believed Dr. North, didn't give him any credit for it. But Gary North, in his radio and blog shows, used to have me on to advise people, because I was had designed high security residents all around the nation, to advise people, what are the safe places? If you're going to leave the city, because it's going to be a meltdown during, well, where do you live? And so I would advise people about that. But I also told Gary, I don't think it's going to be a collapse, because I think the government's going to fix this problem. And except for five major incidents, they did fix it. But there were five major incidents, including an air traffic control glitch and other things.
About Y2K, right?
Right. I'm sorry, Y2K.
Why did they not let it happen?
Well, you see, Gary North was, he believed in a certain Christian viewpoint called Reconstruction. And it's a particular doctrinal viewpoint that before the Second Coming, the Christians have to take back the nation and reconstruct it and hand it back to Christ as a whole wonderful nation. Now, I never bought into that. I feel like Satan will continue to have power in the world, and he certainly is having that power. But I did. Gary felt that Y2K was the gift of God to bring down the government so that we could reconstruct it. I think it was a flawed Christian scenario. In fact, you know, I viewed the globalists, you know, are very much in power. It's too early. They don't want to collapse. They don't want to be blamed for it. So they're going to fix it. And I was right.
Okay.
Well, in the year 2000, I got a lot of requests for my information about strategic relocation. And that's when I wrote the book, Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places. It's now in its third edition. And it covers everything in North America, all the states of the union, all the threats. It rates every state according to all the threats, from gun control to medical laws to freedom of speech to licensing and zoning. It's a very, very comprehensive book, crime rates. It covers everything about every state and province in Canada. And it's really been a bestseller in the field of preparedness to help people understand where are the safe places if you've got to leave the big city, which frankly are not safe because of the high density population areas in all the major cities. Before I wrote Strategic Relocation in the 1980s, 1983 and 84, I was called to go back to Washington to be chairman of the Conservative National Committee during the Reagan administration.
Okay.
And during that time, I was able to really understand how government works, how the left liberals or illiberals, as my brother Mark, the economist, calls them, controlled the Reagan administration, even though he was a legitimate conservative. In order for him to get elected, he had to accept George H.W. Bush, a globalist, as his vice president and allow him to control personnel in the White House. And so it was a mess. And Ronald Reagan still fought them tooth and nail, and that's why they threw that assassination attempt. They intended to kill him, but they didn't. Yeah. It didn't happen. But it sure made him a believer that the deep state has real power, and so he was much more compliant after that. He and Nancy, in fact, Nancy got him into seances with the dark spiritual side trying to get some protection, used right. Gene Dixon and other people to try to foresee the future, which was not wise, but in any case, that's what happened to the Reagan.
He said a lot of good things before that, right?
Yes, he did.
Government being the problem and stuff.
Yeah, but then he compromised. He gave us the biggest tax raise in history with the Social Security tax raise. He gave us for the first amnesty for illegal aliens, saying this is the end, and it wasn't right. the end. You know, it still kept coming in. So, and unfortunately, Reagan did not, in fact, bring down the Soviet Union through the arms race. I'll explain later on when I go into detail that the Soviet Union decided, you know, yes, we can't compete with the West and things, but we're going to fake our own demise in order to get the West to give us aid and trade. In fact, the West came through and built up the Russian oil industry so that it is what it is today, one of the largest oil producers, thanks to U.S. technology that we gave.
Right. And military technology too, right?
That's right. And military technology. But through that experience in Washington, I gained my first experiences with the all-seeing eye of government. For example, I speak multiple foreign languages, and so I was very active in Latin America. I'd lived there before for several years, and I was very active in starting some of the freedom movements in El Salvador and Guatemala. And I was on the telephone one day speaking to some of my sources in Spanish and telling them not to trust a certain lieutenant colonel in the military who was advising them. And within 15 minutes, that colonel was in front of my desk yelling to me, "Don't you ever mention me again on the telephone."
Wow.
So they were spying on people's telephone calls clear back in 1983.
Wow.
And so I learned a great deal about that. I developed a lot of sources. I actually started publishing my World Affairs Briefing when I was in Washington. It was a paper edition at that time. And I restarted that. I left Washington, by the way, because I was a little disenamored with the conservative movement. I found out that a lot of the conservative fundraising people for these organizations, you know, promising to go to fight for a certain cause in Congress, that 90% of those funds were going to support the salaries of the organization, and very little of that ever got into the fight. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up leaving of Washington. I mean, they were sincere people, but it was a little bit disingenuous to fundraise and then keep most of the money for your personal salaries.
And the comment that you made about spying on the phone in 83, they didn't just record your phone call, they immediately got it to the person involved.
That's right.
Which one of the things that makes me wonder is, what's the organization behind that? Because in the 80s, the public didn't really have anything that you could call computers, or, you know, in the modern sense, but they had something, technology, which immediately hooked it up with the right person and got him to come physically over to see you. There's something more in that than just recording your call or listening to it.
Well, they did have big computers in those days. They were mammoth room-sized things, but they did have computational skills to be able to do that. But what it showed was, and I was warning about this in Latin America, because we had a State Department people. I was involved in the beginning of the Arena Party. It's Spanish for sand, but it has another acronym in Spanish. It was a constitutionalist-type party, which was trying to emulate free market economics and constitutional liberties in El Salvador, just like we have in the United States. And, you know, there was a typical ex-military strongman who was fronting the party, very handsome and charismatic, a little bit, you know, they always lack some moral problems, as most of your Latin American strongmen, but he was a good person. He believed in liberty. But he had somebody come into the party headquarters, which was struggling for several years initially, with a good deal of money, a couple $100,000, which in El Salvador was a lot of money in those days in the 80s.
Right.
And he said, you know, you have to take a little more moderate approach for me to, you know, give you this money. So there's the hook coming in. You know, we'll give you lots of money to be able to program. By the way, the Arena Party is the top party in El Salvador, but it only became that after a State Department person told me, when I complained about this, this money was coming for the National Endowment of Democracy, supposedly to foment. But he told me, he said, look, you can have any political party you want in El Salvador as long as it's socialist. Now, this was an American embassy person talking to me.
Wow, wow. That must have made you think about some things.
We don't want anything, you know, like the Constitution down here. You know, we don't want this. We want socialism. These people like socialism. They need socialism. So that was a real eye-opener. The deep state was in existence clear back then. This is not a new phenomenon just because of Donald Trump.
Right.
But in any case, this gave me a world of experience. And so a lot of what I know today, I know because I've lived in Washington. I access foreign language services, which, you know, there's a tremendous difference between Reuters in Germany, Reuters in the UK versus Reuters in the United States. Stuff that gets over there gets filtered here so that we don't see it. And so I'm able to access a lot of that stuff. I mean, there's a lot of criticism of America and the NSA and other things that you see overseas that doesn't get over here. Mm-hmm. Where our media is totally controlled by the deep state here. So that's basically the history of where I'm coming from and my background. I've been writing the World Affairs Brief since the year 2000, so I have a lot of experience in watching these things. My specialty is explaining this special, if not nefarious, contradiction within our government, why it both fights and supports terrorism, drugs, and communist revolutions at the same time. In other words, it fights a war on drugs, but it imports drugs. Has since the Vietnam War. When they asked you just to stuff the body bags of American soldiers coming back with cocaine.
Yeah.
You know, be imported into the U.S.
Well, if you do that in the context of an official war on drugs, it makes them illicit and much more valuable, right? Especially if you have the monopoly.
But it's not just the economic reasons of making it more value. It's the fact that we're going to cover for the fact that we are an illegal government doing illegal things by doing some right things. That's why in the FBI, there's a white side and there's a black side of the FBI. And the white side doesn't know what the black side is doing. In the CIA, there's a white side of the CIA, which does normal espionage for anti-communist purposes. And then there's a dark side, which foments revolutions, foments communism, brings Castro to power, brought the Sandinistas to power in Nicaragua.
So the good and the bad are both controlled by the deep state, though, right?
Well, but the good side doesn't know that the bad side exists within their own organizations. It's very compartmentalized. It's very secretive.
But they're being at least allowed to exist by the deep state.
Which? The white side?
The good side.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's important. I mean, when I had my run-ins in Washington with the CIA, this is a very interesting story. I had a doctor who was subscribing to my newsletter, the World Affairs Brief, in Dallas, and one of his patients was from El Salvador. And he had been hired by the FBI at a salary of $70,000 a year to infiltrate the Salvadorian communists within Texas, which are called the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. CISPES was the acronym. And he found out that they were planning on assassinating President Reagan when he came to Texas. And so he tells his FBI handler this thing, and the FBI handler loses the information and stops paying him and tells him, don't tell anybody about this. And so the poor guy was running out of money. He comes to this doctor friend, finds out he's conservative, and pours out his soul to him. And the doctor calls me in Washington and says, hey, can you find out what's going on with this informant and why the FBI doesn't want to hear about this assassination attempt? and to get him, and I said, well, look, find out what his code name is so that they'll be believable when I call, you know, the FBI.
Right.
So he find out what his code name was, gave it to me. I didn't have any direct contacts at FBI headquarters, but I did in the CIA. So I called my CIA friend and I said, would you call the FBI and find out about this guy? And he did. They asked him, well, who is this guy? And he gave him the code name. And he said, he called me right back and he said, wow, the whole headquarters just went ballistic. They wanted to know, I mean, here's a little informant in right. Texas who doesn't think anybody knows about him, that thinks everyone's forgotten about him, and the whole headquarters knows that code name and knows the problem here.
Wow.
And my FBI or CIA guy says, hey, they want me to know where I get this information, who had this name. I'm going to have to tell him your name. I said, fine, tell him my name. And so within about a half an hour, I had two clean-cut FBI agents at my doorstep wanting to know one thing, who else knows about this informant? And I said, look, I'm not going to tell you. I just want to get this guy paid. I just want this information in front of the government about this. And you could tell these are the guys on the white side. They had been sent down here just to twist my arm and get the names and go back to the office, and I wouldn't do it. So this was before cell phones, and the guy said, hey, can I use your phone? And so he went into the kitchen to use the phone, and I heard him say, no, he won't tell me. He won't tell me. And, well, I can't shoot him, you know. He won't tell me. So you could tell he's under a lot of pressure.
Right.
So, but it's interesting that after that, I knew this was an important guy. So speaking Spanish, I flew down to Dallas to interview this guy personally. And when I was interviewing, he told me a very interesting story. He said, you know, this FBI agent, when we were on good terms, he took me to a party one night. And at this party, I noticed that everybody had this big fancy class ring on, like an Annapolis class ring or something. I asked him about it. And he said to me, kind of in a low voice, he says, well, you know, Congress doesn't even know we exist. That he pointed over there, that guy's CIA, that guy's DEA, that guy's FBI, that guy's, you know, customs union and this and that.
Uh-huh.
And he said, we have our own source of funding. Congress doesn't know we exist. We are a special event. We do what the agencies can't do because it's illegal. That's what he told him.
Right.
And so he got a glimpse into the deep state clear back in 1983.
Well, when he said that we do what the agencies can't do, what was the definition of we?
We meaning we guys of the various agents who are on the dark side, we're on the black side. He wouldn't use that term. But by saying that...
Dark side of CIA or above that?
No, he was saying these are the actual enforcement agents working on illegal activities for CIA, FBI, DEA. And they know each other. But nobody within their agencies on the white side knows that they're on the dark side. In other words, they think the white guys think everybody's on the white side.
Right.
The guys on the dark side know there's an invisible wall between black and white, and we're on the dark side. And he said, Congress doesn't know that we exist, and we have our own source of funding outside of Congress. Now,
okay.
That meant either drug money, probably drug money in those days, or, as it is nowadays, it's just they print the money for them.
Well, right. Yeah, you just make a computer entry, actually.
You just make a computer entry. It's just like what James Mattis said when he spoke before an investment conference, a private investment conference. He says, you wouldn't believe the trillions of dollars that are going into the secret space program.
Right.
More than what is being budgeted. Much more, he said. What I think he was referring to is secret weapons that are space-based, that part of my theory I'll tell you later on, I don't think will be used to defend the United States, but will be used for a globalist military at some point.
Yeah, I think there are levels of awareness of this kind of thing and clearance that go way above presidential level. And the president is pretty much a figurehead that... Yeah. Doesn't know about most of it. I think that's one of the things that really upset Kennedy before he got killed.
That's right.
He found out what he didn't know about.
That's right. He, for example, went to bed the night of the Bay of Pigs having authorized the airstrikes. And unbeknownst to him, McGeorge Bundy canceled them, George McBundy was CFR. He was a globalist. He was part of the conspiracy. He canceled the airstrike.
Yeah.
Kennedy was livid in the morning when he found out the airstrikes had been canceled. And that's when he vowed that I'm going to destroy the secret side of the CIA. And that's when they vowed he's a dead man.
Yeah, exactly. A bunch of things at once. So, yeah, didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought there. But when you found out about the good and the bad side of the agencies, what was your official position? And did they try to drag you across that wall or not?
No, they didn't, because although I was chairman of the Conservative National Committee, it was still a private organization trying to work with the Reagan administration to keep it on track. And although we had a lot of heavyweight conservatives, none of us were in government per se. And so they didn't want to alert us or even their white side agents that there was an illegal side. So they weren't about to tell them to do an illegal act to us. You see
that? Yeah. Well, they probably have an idea of everybody's psychological profile and the people that are worth trying to bring over to the dark side and the ones that wouldn't be worthwhile.
For example, my brother, who went into the CIA after the, he was an economic analyst there, and he had other friends who were in the espionage side, and they were over in Europe, and young in their careers, at their hotel room one evening, each one of them had a prostitute come to their room and offer their services. And a couple of these were Mormons or LDS, you know, people who didn't believe in that, and straight guys. And they refused them. And at breakfast the morning, you know, and they said, you know, and these prostitutes would say, no, the agency's paying for it. They would encourage them, thinking, you know, this isn't going to cost you a thing.
Yeah, and breakfast, one of your benefits.
At breakfast in the morning, they found out that every one of these young agents had been propositioned. The ones that accepted it advanced in the agency, and the ones that didn't advance.
Right.
Especially in the espionage side. You've got to prove that you have lost your principles in order to get into the deep side.
When you have to give some kind of material for blackmail, or what's the point, right? Nothing can be held against you if not.
Well, they use blackmail to a certain extent. What they really want, though, are willing, corrupt people who don't have to be blackmailed, that really willingly want to promote the agenda. Those are the ones but it starts with blackmail, and then they get further in, and they want to see who's really in there, because they've turned, and you know, against conscience, against what they've done.
So they'd fit right in.
That's right.
Okay.
So let's break at this point and go to my general big picture of where in history of where I think this deep state, at least as far as what we can track with good modern history, began.
Yeah, you know, we might make the theme of this video and the, any that come after it, as that if we want to get right to the point, the history of the deep state. And how it relates to everything else. And so the first question when we transition from your background to that history is, where is the best relevant place to start looking back in time?
The best relevant place to start is the turn of the last century, around the period of 1900.
Okay.
That's when things really started to get active and traceable, where we could track them intervening in the normal course of history and politics in order to put certain well-placed individuals, and they didn't control much at all prior to that time. There was some control in the Spanish-American War, for example. This was a false flag attack. The explosion on the Maine was done by government agent saboteurs, not by the Spanish government. So it would justify the Spanish War. So there were some things going on earlier. I mean, we can go clear back to the Illuminati. We can go back to 1776. And the fact that Masonry and the Illuminati got exposed, they had to switch sides, go underground for a while, a lot of things. But I'm not going to go back that far, because I want to touch on things that people really feel and remember in their history.
Well, when you say that they weren't doing too much stuff before that to influence like they are now and since, you must have in mind who you're talking about, they. Who, before we say what they did, who are they?
Well, that in fact has always been the best kept secret. And we don't know today who they are at the very top. We know who their high-profile public people are.
Right.
All right, but we have never known, and we probably will never know, who is at the top, and I'll tell you why. One of the most interesting things I have discovered, and you'll see this pattern throughout everything I discuss, is that there has been a continuous plan towards globalization since 1900 to destroy American sovereignty, replace it with a world government, right? That's a conspiracy. That's a train of thought that you can trace. There is no single person, evil person, who could have started that out in 1900. He'd be dead by 1930 or 40. And there's no single person that could keep a coherent agenda like that going and still going today. It has to be otherworldly in terms of its direction.
Yeah,
and that's totally why agree. I believe that there is, as there is a God, there is a Satan, and he's given certain powers to intervene with limitations in the earth and to reveal himself.
Right.
I don't think any more than God reveals himself to a few prophets here and there in history so as not to interrupt the testing portions of the earth. Satan's given the power, I think, to intervene and reveal himself. And I think that's what the Faustian Pact was. You know, that Faust, Goethe talked about. And it's throughout a theme in history. People make a pact with the devil to get ahead in life, and he has certain powers to facilitate them. And I think the Faustian Pact really is the essence of granting them immunity from consequences of your sins in this earth life. For a while. In fact, most of these people get away for the whole while.
That's what I mean, for a while.
Yeah. But he even promises them, I think, from a theological standpoint, he even promises immunity from the chains of hell. That is, he promised them, you help me overthrow goodness and the work of God, that you won't have to suffer through hell.
So there will never be any consequences, in other words.
But that's what he promises.
But that may not be entirely honest.
Of course it isn't. In fact, it's interesting, if I may permit me a divergence to the Bible, for example. In Isaiah chapter 14, there's a story about he who is going to thrash the world descending in chains into hell. And the great men of the earth who are in hell waiting for him who is going to save them say, behold, he's become low like unto us. I think this is an allegorical view of Satan promising him to save them from the chains of hell. And then he descends into hell and they realize the jig is up. He's not going to save us.
Before signing that contract, they should have done more of a background check, and they forgot to do that, I guess, right?
But there was a great incentive to sign the immunity, because when you've already full of sin, you know, you don't want to give up your sins.
It sounds like a great benefit. Yeah.
It sounds like a great benefit. Someone's promised me immunity. I'm never going to have to pay for it.
Right.
It's a brilliant thing, and only Satan's capable of it. But I believe ultimately the only explanation for how this keeps going generationally seamlessly is that it's a revealed strategy to those only at the very top.
And we can only guess about them from the clues that are at the visible levels, right?
That's right. I mean, for example, we have our Zbigniew Brzezinski, the Henry Kissingers, the George Soros. We know these people are very high-level globalists, part of this conspiracy. But we don't know who's above them. We don't know.
I mean, they're high-level from this perspective, but from the real total hierarchy, they might be pretty low.
Well, I think they're pretty mid to higher level, frankly, because they're doing an awful lot. And
I'm just saying that's on the human level.
Yes, that's right.
And
but ultimately, this is a very sophisticated satanic deception we're dealing with. And that's why it's so very complex and hard for people to believe. You know, there's so many people who just say, why can't we get along in the world? Why do people have to go to war? Well, you know, they don't realize there is systematic evil in the world.
Now, that's really hard to grasp.
No matter how good most people are, there are people who are downright evil, who are born evil, who are coming to this life to destroy the work of good people.
Right.
So you're never going to have peace just because everybody get along. You have to prepare against evil. You have to be prepared to actively fight against it. That's part of the test of this earth life. See who's got the guts to fight evil, who's got the mental perspicuity to see evil when it's masquerading as good.
Yeah.
To see the wolves in sheep's clothing, that takes real talent.
Well, and to see the depth to which it's pervasive at this point. I mean,
yes.
pretty
much.
Now,
the one good thing about the Trump presidency is we've got to see the deep state come out of the woodwork.
Right,
and,
right.
And unfortunately, as I'll point out later on in briefings that we might do, that Donald Trump, unfortunately, doesn't have the ability or the experience to see who's deep state and who isn't. He replaced Jim Comey, right. deep state, with Christopher Wray, who's deep state.
Yeah. No, I think the only thing that makes him great, is like Kennedy, is that he actually doesn't want to kill the country.
That's right.
I think he sincerely wants to help it, from what
that's
I
That's exactly
say.
Right. He has sincere and glimpses of good instincts, which keeps countering what they talk him into. And that's what riles these globalist advisors to no end, is that Donald Trump keeps changing his mind. They convince him to stay in Afghanistan, and then he wants to get out again.
They almost got him to attack Iran a little while ago, right?
That's right. That's right. His instincts said, I appreciate the fact they didn't shoot down that P-8, which the deep state had put in there so that Americans would have gotten killed, and the Iranians decided to shoot down the drone instead of the P-8. And Trump recognized, aha, they're not the devils they're telling me they are.
right, exactly.
But let's go back to the big picture. Let me give you a right. sweeping overview of how they got us to this point in history okay. by promoting wars. Now, to set the stage for World War I, and the true purpose of World War I was to remove two monarchies which were not under the control of the globalist monetary powers at the time. And that was Russia under the Tsar and Germany under the Kaiser.
Okay.
And so World War II was meant to weaken both of those in war so that Russia could be taken over by a communist revolution, which was financed by British and American globalists.
You mean World War I, right?
World War One.
Yeah.
World
okay.
War I was a prelude to the communist revolution after Russia had been weakened. The communist revolution in 1917 was financed by $20 million in gold from Britain and $20 million from Jacob Schiff of the U.S. globalists.
Yeah.
So the globalists were already in place in Britain and America by the turn of the century and were conniving to do this. And World War One, of course, the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand was just a provocation, meaning to get the war going, but they were intent upon the war for purposes of creating the first global government, and that was going to be the League of Nations.
Right, right. And that was after World War One, right? The League of Nations was supposed to be...
That's right, but the purpose of World War One is what I'm saying. This is part of the... Create a crisis in order to...
Yeah, we're going to solve the problem of world war forever with the League of Nations.
That's right. Yeah. And fortunately, there was enough isolationist opinion, pro-sovereignty opinion, Henry Cabot Lodge and others, in order to stop the League of Nations and Wilson. But Wilson was put in there specifically because he was a controlled individual. He had an affair as a professor at Princeton. It was Princeton. And they held that over, and they put him in as president, and he was under basically lock and key there. In fact, they got him elected through something they did with later on in our political history. They got Theodore Roosevelt to run as a third party candidate in order to split off the conservative vote so that Wilson could be elected. That was the Bull Moose Party Theodore Roosevelt had a big ego. They talked him into running for president again specifically to elect Theodore Roosevelt. So that's one of the beginnings of electoral manipulation.
To elect Wilson, you mean, right?
Yes. What did I say?
Roosevelt. But Wilson turned out to be perfect because he's entrenched the Federal Reserve and the income tax both and a bunch of other stuff too.
That's right. And that happened in 1913. We got the income tax and the Federal Reserve. And this was a conspiracy as well. The banks actually came out because there was a populist feeling against the banks and the big combines, as they would call them. The banks came out and faked being against the Federal Reserve to convince
yes.
people that the Federal Reserve must be good because the bankers are against them. Total deception, total globalist deception.
Yeah.
And there was the creature of Jekyll Island that was done in secret, all kinds of machinations, as well as the income tax coming. Now, to hedge their bets in the League of Nations, they established the Treaty of Versailles, which provided reparations against Germany that no government that was defeated like Germany could ever pay. they knew that it was impossible for Germany to pay those kinds of reparations. And that set the stage for World War II, because in the first place, it also set the stage for socialism, because the Federal Reserve sent over experts to help advise the Weimar Republic and handle how to handle this debt problem. And they told them, inflate your currency, because they had the gold mark at the time. They couldn't inflate the gold mark without losing their gold. And so they told them how to inflate the paper currency.
Now, so under the Kaiser, it was gold-backed, is what you're saying, right?
Pardon me?
In Germany, you're saying under the Kaiser, it was gold-backed currency?
That's right. Gold-backed, the German gold mark.
And that's useless for using money to dominate the world, because you can't have inflation and a lot of other things are restricted.
That's right. And so the inflation was and it's very important when Bretton Woods comes along after the war. Guess what? The U.S. goes to a gold-backed currency. And there's a purpose of that. They couldn't inflate out the gazoo with a gold-backed, but what they could do is become the dominant currency so that all other currencies would be lessened to the dollar. And right. Once they became the dominant currency, then they could go off the gold standard and inflate in order to hide the inflation. Because once you have an international currency, you can inflate at 10 times the rate of other countries, and it gets absorbed internationally. And that's what our government's been able to get away with for many years. Okay. It still does to a great extent. But the important point there is you cannot, the Germans were told by the Fed, that's how you get out of this, you inflate. Now, once that inflation started, now France didn't want the German mark anymore because it was an inflationary mark. Right. And so they invaded the Ruhr land and took over all of the gold and steel and coal producing area of Germany, took all the production. And Germany, because all the people weren't getting paid now in Germany because France was taking the produce without paying for it, Germany decided to pay the salaries of all the Ruhr industrial workers, and they indexed to inflation so that they wouldn't be hurt by the inflation of the currency. Then all the rest of the German nations demanded that their income be indexed to inflation. That's how you get spiraling inflation, is when the government indexes it so that everybody's salaries automatically rise. Now, if you don't have indexing, you get stagflation, meaning that when it gets to about 15 or 20%, the poor can't buy anymore and the economy starts to go down. That's the natural cap on inflation. When it gets to 15 or 20%,
demand falls at that point. In other words,
demand falls and it inflates in called stagflation. We had that in 1976.
Yeah.
When we had high inflation without indexing and people stopped buying, or at least a portion of the people stopped buying so that it tamped down on it. And so a lot of people in the conservative field warn about economic collapse because we have a fiat currency. You can't have hyperinflation without indexing. And on the Federal Reserve and the government know this very much. That's why they have falsified the rate of inflation, to keep inflationary expectations low. They keep telling us it's 1.5%.
Yeah, all right.
It's actually been 6 to 7% for 20 years. And people can adjust to 6 and 7%. It creates a hardship. But you can adjust over time. We have been adjusting for 20 years over this. Prices keep rising. But it's not enough to hurt the economy. Now, and that's why they have to suppress interest rates. Because when you keep doing deficit spending, you hit that point where you can't pay the interest on the debt. And they keep postponing that by suppressing the interest rates. If the interest rates they were paying were 6 to 7%, we'd be bankrupt in 2 or 3 years.
So they just encourage borrowing instead to put it off, right?
And the only way they can encourage borrowing from the government is by paying a below market interest rate.
Yeah, I mean, by keeping the rate low.
By telling people it's only 1.5% inflation or 2% inflation, which is a lie, but it keeps people from getting into that inflationary fever, rush out and buy before the prices rise.
Right.
So World War II comes along, and it's interesting that even during World War II, before the United Nations was formed in 1949, the United States was using the term United Nations in their communications with the military, but the Supreme Allied Command was under United Nations. So they already had a global government formed. Eisenhower was very much a part of this. and implemented a lot of very evil things at the end of World War II. Some of the greatest crimes in history happened. Number one, Stalin had taken about 6,000 U.S. prisoners and 6,000 British prisoners into the gulags of the Soviet Union, having liberated them from the Nazi camps. He kept that secret, and he used that as bargaining leverage so that Eisenhower would, in fact, do Operation Keelhaul, which was taking by force all of the Eastern Europeans, even those that had never lived in Russia, and forcibly repatriating them back to the Soviet Union to go into the work camps. Now, that was the deal that that Roosevelt made at Yalta with Stalin, which was very, very evil. Stalin still did not release the British and American troops, and the U.S. government never said anything to the American people about that betrayal. We left all of those thousands of British and American troops in, and they've died in the gulags. Now, that's one of the greatest conspiracies in history that has never been told to people. Another great crime was done by the British. There was an entire army of Germans that fought against the Russians on the Allied side. And when the war ended, the British disarmed them and marched them, told them they were going for R&R, put them in trucks, and then marched them into the camps and turned them over to the Soviets. They went into the gulag.
Why do you think they did that?
Well, the globalists, you see, and this goes to World War I, World War II, and World War III, the globalists use war and conflict to build future enemies and to create conflict and rearrange countries and other things. I mean, World War I, they promised the Arabs their own independence if they would fight on the side of the Allies. They betrayed them. They didn't give them any. They cobbled together Iraq out of three different Sunni and Shiite and Kurdish people, which was never should have been under one country. They should have given the Kurds their separate country and the Shiites and the Sunnis their. But you see, they purposely cobbled things together to create conflict. So they have future wars to justify other attacks on sovereignty. And so this is very important to understand why they did that. They were trying to also build an enemy. The Soviet Union had agreed with Russia, I mean to Germany, to carve up Poland and to kind of rule the world together. And then the Soviets were going to betray the Germans. The Germans beat them first to the punch. And now the Soviets became beleaguered. Well, the globalists decided to take on the Soviets as allies, not only to beat Hitler, but to build up a future enemy for the Third World War, which we're yet to see. And that's why all this lend-lease, we built Russian truck factories, we built aircraft factories, we gave them aircraft, we gave them washing machines, sewing machines, even while American housewives had nothing.
Were sacrificed. What year did that start in, all that aid?
Oh, that aid started in 1943 or so, 44, 45. That's where the big years of Soviet aid was going.
During the war.
During the war, of course, because Soviet Union was now our ally.
Okay.
They got preference on everything.
Right.
Now, one of the greatest evils, though, is that this lend-lease at the end of the war continued. For example, Major Racy Jordan, manning one of the Air Force bases in Montana, through which everything went to the Soviet Union on lend-lease, saw the diplomats carrying six big heavy suitcases, trunks. He got suspicious about it, and so he stopped them, and he said, I'm going to open those trunks. No, no, you can't. It's diplomatic luggage. Well, he opens them up, and it contained plans to the nuclear weapons that they couldn't steal at the Manhattan Project. So he confiscates the packages, and while he's got them in his office, he gets a call from the White House. In other words, the Russians had called one of their agents, Alger Hiss or Owen Lattimore, in the White House, of the administration, and they called Racy Jordan, read the riot, and said, give those back to me. He said, yeah, but they're plans to the nuclear weapons. He said, we don't care. Give them back to the Russians and don't ever tell anyone about it.
Wow.
That's the kind of conspiracy that was going on. Now, that's not the worst of it. A year later, the U.S. gave the first shipment of the enriched uranium to the Russians so that they could explode their first nuclear weapon a year after Hiroshima. They didn't know how to enrich uranium. We gave them the first shipment.
Right. And well, be careful saying we. I mean, you're talking about the globalists with their minions within the government, right?
That's right. That's right.
Didn't really represent the American people.
That's right.
I know we're running out of time, but we're just getting started, if you agree with me on that. And maybe on the next chapter, we could do more on World War One and Two, how they fit together and what happened in between. The League of Nations ending up with the United Nations and what's developed in the phase after that. We've got a lot more to get into, and I just don't want to keep you longer than we agreed to. But.
That's fine. Let me just end, though, by capping the overall big picture that when George Catlin Marshall came out of the globalist Supreme Allied Command and was part of the Truman administration, being a globalist, was the one who cut off aid to Chiang Kai-shek in China and handed China to Mao Zedong, who was still getting arms from the Soviet Union. And so you see, you had World War One, you had World War Two, which gave us finally a global government, but it had no power. It has no military, essentially. It has no taxing power. Mm-hmm. It has no power, et cetera. And so what I'm saying in terms of the big picture, the globalists intend to give us one more war that'll finally destroy American sovereignty and get us into a militarized global government with taxing power and the kind of regulatory power that the Britons hated so much in the EU. And they're not going to let Britain out of the EU and free from that taxing power. So that's a story for next time. We'll talk about how they're going to get us to World War III, how they're going to use Russia and China with a preemptive strike to get us in there, and why, once you're in a new world order, they'll never let you out.
Right, and the United Nations, of course, has a big role to play in the whole thing, too.
At least for now, but I think it's going to be a different organization that will exclude communists, finally, when they get
that organization may already be started, it's just not in the newspapers and on TV.
So. Yeah, I think that the new move to create a EU military union is, in fact, the seed stock for the militarized global government.
That would come out of the EU, morph out of the EU.
Right.
Which is actually already well along putting its military together, I think.
Yeah.
So, incredible, Joel. It reminds me of what real classes with actual teachers in them were like. It's exciting. So, hope you're open to continuing.
I am.
Shortly.
So I hope your audience will look forward to another installment of how the deep state really works and how it affects us today.
Episode 2. These things should be known everywhere. And I think we're definitely time to do that at this point. So hold on and we'll say goodbye in the break here.
Thank you.
So I think Doug and I are in agreement with a commentary on Joel's presentation there. And our extremely impressive review is, wow, that was some electrified information. And I've never heard for several years I've been listening to Joel on the other show that we can't mention very much. And he's always restricted to these little segments. And I always had the feeling intuitively that there's a lot more there that he's not getting a chance to say. And I'd like to see him get free rein to expand, knit it all together, and then most importantly to say, oh, what do you do with that? You know, it's all very nice to know. This is how you're being destroyed, and all these bad things are happening, and here are the kind of people that are in charge, and they've infiltrated all the way down to the local level in the U.S. and probably most of the world. Yeah, that's great to understand that, but it doesn't really help you unless you can translate that into something to do. And Joel has written the book Strategic Relocation, among others, which says where is a good place to live if you have a choice in the coming period, and especially to not stay in the middle of a really crazy city if you can arrange a way to not stay there. But I haven't heard him talk at all about how groups of individuals should go someplace and try to set up a cooperative situation where you help each other. And most of the intentional communities I've heard, especially made up of people who are very independent minded, and a lot of the audience that we're probably talking to, they don't get along long term in a lot of cases because they value their freedom and independence very highly, which I think is normal. But what I want to move toward after the history part and the current events understanding, which hopefully we'll update periodically, what do you do between now and when these more interesting things start happening and it gets intense in America and probably a lot of other places in the world? What are you supposed to do? I mean, probably he would say don't try to do everything on your own in complete isolation, though many of us are pulled toward that. So I want to hear his version of what you should do. In the meantime, check out his books, which are still for sale widely. You can find them, Strategic Relocation, The Secure Home, and a couple of others at least. Those are for sale, and then you can go to his site, worldaffairsbrief.com. And he's got this offer that I've heard many times. I think it's still valid. If you write to editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, you can get a free copy to see if you like it and see if it's worthwhile, something that you'd like to have as a news source. I got it, and it was very well done. The books are very well done, the ones that I've read. So I would recommend that. And in the meantime, just in case, especially now, we're getting into this stuff with Joel. This is not the average level information, as you may have noticed. Go to lostartsradio.com and sign up for our newsletter, because, or not a newsletter, mailing list. We're not even doing a newsletter. Joel's doing that. We're not even doing the mailing list, anything with it right now. But if it becomes the only way we can get this information to you, maybe able to embed videos in it or something like that, sign up on that. It's free, and you just need to give us the email address to send it to. Might be a good idea now, instead of saying that, oh, these interesting people are gone and we don't have any contact. That will keep us in touch, as well as our presence on brighteon.com, brighteon.com/channel/lostartsradio. That's one that will not be censored. Mike has put a lot of money and time and effort and great ideas into it. It's about to include live streaming in the near future. Really good thing to start watching videos on brighteon.com. Also band.video, band.video. All the other alternative platforms that are starting up in to try and, if they can do it in time, to give us non-censoring platforms like MeWe and Gab and Dissenter as a search engine. That's one that I'm just getting myself. There's a bunch of others that I probably don't even know about yet. So check, stay up to date on that. The Sunday shows like this one will continue as long as we're able on all the main public platforms that we can get onto and stay on. The Saturday show in the afternoon is Lost Arts Radio Live at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern. That's going on every week. And the Planetary Healing Club meeting right after that, that's a more private platform, less subject to censorship. And on that one, I can talk about my own experimental research over the last 50-some years into age reversal and getting rid of and reversing degenerative diseases, maximum immunity without chemical interventions, things that you might find useful, and it's tied into a lot of deeper consciousness issues, which you really need when you're trying to change physical lifestyle habits that you know are not good for you, but you're really attached to them. And it's a form of addiction, and we all have it to some degree. And so you might learn, oh, if you just do this, it'll naturally start helping you get your energy back and your health back and everything without all the drug stuff and invasive procedures. But you run into brick walls of emotional attachment. So if you want to talk about specific life and health issues, and not me being a doctor or anything, just is still legal at this point, at least, to share deep information on these things. If you're ready to do the work and you're curious about it, check out our access point at planetaryhealingclub.com, and you can get in that way. There are small dues, but those go to the nonprofit and help us keep this work going at least for a while, and hopefully in the future, if we get enough funds in and some friendly billionaire finds out about us with no strings attached, we want to build a school. And I've got full details. If we had the money, we could do that tomorrow. We need help on that. We need donations. We're not pushing products, as you may have mentioned. I haven't felt any that I really want to throw my energy into, because when I recommend something to you, I want it to be because I think it's really good, not because I say, wow, if I get 1,000 people to buy this, look at the money we can get. It's not that that's bad for selling something good. It's that because of the work I do, I need to be really clear in when I recommend something. It's not necessarily because I'm going to make money on it. It's because you're part of my family and I want you to know about it, like right now, or something that I didn't have a good experience, the same sort of thing. So we need donations as a result. And we have a new page called Subscribestar. And you can go there, subscribestar.com/lostartsradio. If you want to, it's the kind of thing where you can do something one time, or you can donate $1 a month and tell 1 million of your friends to do the same thing. And we can build a school right away if you do that. Or if you're that friendly billionaire that we're still looking for that has a feeling for the value of what we're trying to do, donate more, and we'd really appreciate it very much. And if you want private sessions with me, some of those are still available for consulting. I can't call it counseling because that's tied up by the official counseling profession, right? But talking about stuff that you're not going to find elsewhere in the same perspective. Write to me if you want a private session, and that'll help support us as well. Richard@lostartsradio.com email, and I'll read it and respond. I think that's all the stuff I'm supposed to remember to tell you, and that's about it. Watch the Sunday shows and comment, questions, anything like that. Send those by email too, and I'll be glad to see that and respond as time allows. Really appreciate your awareness of what's going on this planet that we're living on, trying to make it better for everybody, not just ourselves. And we have work to do, and it starts with 100% working on yourself, not going around trying to force other people to change. The hidden key is, if you really want to help anybody else, your family or your extended family, that you realize everybody's connected, the hidden key that releases the power to do that effectively is work on yourself. It takes more courage and willingness to look at stuff that most of us want to keep the attention off of at all costs. But that's where the hidden power point is. No fear, nothing, no worry about anything like that. Just do the work. And that's what we're doing in Planetary Healing Club. Every week, planetaryhealingclub.com. But you can absolutely do it yourself. And if you want a boost doing it, one-to-one session with me, that's open too. Whatever is good for you. So that's the ideas that we're working on. Every day that we've got before things get more intense is very valuable, and I just suggest we use it the best we can. Learn everything that you can. Upgrade yourself, and that's going to affect absolutely everybody everywhere. It's actually real. So thanks for the time, for being with us, and Joel will be back. He wants to do this as a series continuously, so we don't get off track. And I think it's an incredible opportunity. We'll try to do a good job with it. And if you have questions that you want brought up to him, send them. You know, this is an incredible opportunity. Richard@lostartsradio.com. That's not just for the private sessions with me. That's questions for Joel, because he's coming back. The idea that he agreed to do this is incredible. I mean, we should take advantage of it. It's going to go to some interesting places. If you got questions or comments, feel free to send them in. And otherwise, just have your chair ready for listening next week. He'll be back, and we'll see you next time. Have a good week.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio on Subscribestar.com. Just go to Subscribestar.com/Lost Arts Radio to find our rewards program, offering 10 different giving levels starting at just $5 a month. We offer incredible value for any rewards level, from extra monthly interview videos not available publicly to subscription-based Planetary Healing Club videos once, twice, or three times a month, to private counseling sessions with Lost Arts Radio host Richard Sachs, to tech help with me, Doug Diamond. We even have one option where you can be the star on Lost Arts Radio as our guest on a specially produced show just for you. We conduct an interview with you and broadcast it to our growing network and listenership. Our subscribe star levels are one of a kind and offer great rewards for any budget. Please help support Lost Arts Radio. We can't do it without you. With increasing censorship on many of our channels, we really need your support today to keep doing what we're doing. As Richard says, we're not even at survival level yet. Lost Arts Radio has three weekly shows. Lost Arts Radio Live each Saturday night at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, which is a live stream currently on multiple platforms in case we get banned from some of the larger ones. Right now, we're on two YouTube channels, Facebook Live, Periscope, which is Twitter, Twitch, and DLive. You can access these broadcasts by going to www.lostartsradio.com/live for all the links to those channels. The Planetary Healing Club meets right after Lost Arts Radio Live at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. And our Sunday show with guests airs at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Sunday nights on our Blog Talk Radio channel, our YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and on Brighteon. Be sure to sign up for our free email list just in case we do get banned on big tech's platforms. It's just a matter of time, really. They don't like the stuff we talk about, and they do not want the truth out there. In fact, they have already attacked us numerous times. Join our free email list so we can let you know where we are and how to access our shows. The sign-up button is right on the top right on most pages of our website. The best starting point for all things Lost Arts Radio is our main site, lostartsradio.com, where you can find the hottest news selection videos that we curate just for you. Those are on the homepage and added to daily, as well as articles and breaking news about information you really need to know. Our show archives, the 10 most recent shows, are right on our homepage, as well as our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/lostartsradio, or just click the All Things Radio Show tab right on our website. We're in the podcast directory on iTunes, and all of our shows except the banned ones are on our YouTube channels at Lost Arts Radio and at Diamond Disc. Our Brighteon page is really taking off, and we often have editor's picks videos right on their homepage. Visit brighteon.com/channel/Lost Arts Radio. On our site, you can also access our free listener forum as well as sign up for the Planetary Healing Club, which is just $25 a month, where you get private access to a one-on-one interaction with host Richard Sachs and myself and the other club members who participate live. More info can be found at planetaryhealingclub.com. We're providing solutions in there to make the world a better place. Come join us. Stay tuned because up next, you'll get to hear a really great song by an independent artist that we're doing our best to support. Go to lostartsradio.com/music for the full list of all the great songs and bands that we spin on our audio-only podcast shows. If you're in a band and want to submit a song for consideration for airplay on Lost Arts Radio, visit my website at diamonddiscaudio.com for more information about the music placement, mastering, and mixing work that I do. Thanks again for listening to and supporting Lost Arts Radio. We love having you as part of our family to learn, experience, and grow with. To be the